You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One here in the heart of London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show, I'll discuss the day's top news stories with the FT's Martin Sanbu and James Schneider from New African Magazine. We'll be talking about Canada's election of Justin Trudeau and the Liberals and ask what will happen as the country lurches to the left. Plus, a ceremonial welcome is given to China's President Xi Jinping on his state visit to the UK. We'll pick apart a very divided reaction that he's been given. Plus, as Pegida grows in power in Germany and the SVP make gains in Switzerland's elections, we'll ask just how much Europe's refugee crisis is rattling the cages of the right wing. Those topics all to come in the next half hour here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today, James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African Magazine, and Martin Sanbu, a columnist at the Financial Times. Geographically, we range widely today, China, North America and Europe, and we shall end our journey in Africa. Welcome both to the programme. Let's begin as locally as we possibly can get with the noise of helicopters that have been rattling overhead here in London, not to mention the echo just audible here at Midori House of a 103 gun salute for the state visit of China's President Xi Jinping. Banquets with the Duchess of Cambridge await later, but it was standing room only for President Xi's address to the United Kingdom earlier on today. Martin, let's begin with you. What was your reaction to Xi Jinping's address today? It was all very much the emphasis on friendship.
Of course it was. China has all interest in being liked. There's a sort of bigger question in where the UK fits into this, because it all smacks a bit of desperation. It's a bit a sort of mix of making up for having seen the Dalai Lama a couple of years ago and really being very desperate to get some Chinese business going, and maybe even to show that the UK can be global even when it's inside Europe. There are a lot of things going into this. I think China is clearly has the advantage here. China is one of the biggest economies in the world. Pretty much every European politician runs down their doors to try to get business contracts. And China has a lot of money to invest. So in a sense, I think for China, a lot of this is just basking in the glory that that the UK government is freely giving out of.
Right, let's build upon this glory that the UK government is freely building upon. James, we've seen quite a lot of harsh reaction to the incredibly warm welcome that that Xi Jinping has been given, not least the ceremonial welcome, but the fact that the United Kingdom, the British government, has been pushing hard on wanting to make China its great trade partner, plus this astonishing revelation that the Chinese will help with the construction of this nuclear power plant that the British military has said is absolute folly. Other countries have been saying, what are you doing? Throwing their hands up in despair. When you see the influence that China has had in Africa, what do you think China will do over here?
Probably not that similar, actually. The thing I find rather peculiar about this, about how the reddest of the red carpets, as some Chinese state media said that's been laid out, is the timing of all of this. Because it seems like it's 5 years too late within the Cameron Osborne discourse. At the beginning of their leadership, along with, you know, assisted by Nick Clegg and the Lib Dems, there was this talk about the global race, about how Germany gets all of the great trade with China, and Britain wants more of it. And of course, at that time, China was all rising, and also the Chinese leadership at that time were focused a lot more on soft power, on reaching out, and it seems slightly peculiar to have it now when you're giving a lot away. You have an opposition who are calling for renationalisation, which you say is nonsense, but you'll allow state-owned companies from other countries to come and buy your national assets. Of course, there's the example of the nuclear plant you gave out. And as we all know, there are issues going on within the Chinese economy, and there are issues going on within a crackdown in China, some of which looks like it's a very good focus on corruption, some of which looks like it might be significantly politicised, and this is helping that and helping solidify Xi's more authoritarian rule. So it just strikes a slightly off note, as you appreciate it. It doesn't quite seem the right timing from the British. And I mean, obviously, it's all great for Xi. They come over, they're the biggest economy in the world by PPP, and get a wonderful welcome.
Martin, how much is the UK giving away, as James just said?
Well, I was just thinking that the timing. There's also a different government now here in the UK than there was in the previous parliament, and I suppose the Lib Dems were trying to play a little bit the role of conscience to the coalition government. David Cameron and George Osborne are very smart politicians, and I think much of this is really George Osborne's strategy. He's a pragmatic but strategic politician, and I think he's shown, actually, in the domestic economic policy in the previous parliament that he can take a gamble and he will follow through. He did that with austerity. He trusted the advisors who said, in 3-4 years, things will pick up. That's what happened. But he had to go for 2-3 years with terrible economic results. Probably something similar is going on now. He has put all his, not all his eggs in one basket, but he thinks China will continue to grow, that the current turmoil in the Chinese economy is just that, temporary turmoil, and that this is the place to be, and he wants to be the first most important European nation. That's the rhetoric.
Do you think that strategy will work?
I think the risks are bigger than presumably he does. I'm among the skeptics about the Chinese economy. I think the current troubles are bigger than they have seemed and may turn bigger still. There's a huge debt problem domestically in China, and we've seen elsewhere in the world how large corporate, private and public debts can derail an economy very badly. So I think the risks are bigger. But there's something very bold in making a choice about where the future lies in the global economy and going with it. I think that's admirable. I just hope that he's right and I'm wrong rather than the other way around.
I think it is also looking at it the wrong way around. If you want to, as far as I see it, if you're an advanced industrialized nation and you want to have increased trade with China, then you want to have the kind of high tech manufacturing, the kind of goods that China currently needs to, well, doesn't only need to import, but does need to import. How Germany has such a positive trade relationship with China. And it seems that rather than setting up the kind of policies that would encourage those industries in Britain and say, and we, of course we wish to trade with China, and the part of the reason why we're developing these industries of the future, or however you would phrase it, is in order to meet this Chinese and other growing demand. But the other way around, saying, right, we're going to have this big relationship with China and we're going to see which bits of Thames water they can get, and we're going to see which bits of our utilities we can sell off. And we decided that we're not going to borrow for an investment for some completely bonkers political calculus. So we're going to need to get money from somewhere. So we're going to have to get in outside investment at a worse deal for us. So it seems the wrong way around.
I agree with most of that. I see the risk slightly differently. I think that if Osborne is right, if China pulls off the current troubles and keeps growing fast, it won't be very long before it becomes richer and will have a greater demand, not just for the sort of manufacturing goods that China is good at, but the sort of services that the UK is good at, legal services, financial services. And we see that there are attempts to link up the Chinese financial markets with the City of London and so on. So there is a sort of, rosy scenario you can paint
but
there. What I worry a bit about is whether you tie yourself too much into an economy that's so much bigger than yours, and if your infrastructure is completely run by it, you kind of end up not having very much say about how things are run.
I think you're right. So just to come in very quickly, I think you're right that the services angle, because of course when Cameron went to China a couple of years ago, he brought all of the big four accountancy firms with him. But I see an enormous paradox there, because Xi is trying to stop this enormous illicit capital flight that comes out of China, which is facilitated by services companies wearing nice suits who have London offices, even if they're headquartered technically in other jurisdictions that perhaps have a bit more secrecy. So there is a contradiction there between the kinds of services that we can provide at the very top level, which London does extremely well, and the kind of economy that she would like to run, and the kind of way he'd like to rebalance power between himself and lots of the elite that are trying to take their capital abroad.
What do you think, Martin, of the more general picture of the way that the United Kingdom sees its financial interests? We were talking about how so much of China owns so much of increasing chunks of the United Kingdom, Thames Water, a big bit of the Shard, the Shangri-La is based there. Even Pizza Express is Chinese owned. To what degree are the British missing a trick insofar as we are allowing, or the United Kingdom is allowing, foreign ownership and foreign investment to take slices of the family silver, while the United Kingdom, George Osborne, is not seeking to invest and strengthen its financial position abroad?
Well, some of this is a necessary consequence of the fact that even if Chancellor Osborne will tell you that Britain is paying down its debt, maybe the government is reining in its debt, but Britain as a nation is not. The current account deficit, which is the imbalance vis-a-vis the rest of the world, private and public, is large and increasing. So if you're borrowing more from abroad as an entire economy, if you're borrowing on net, then the result is that gradually foreigners will take ownership stakes in your companies. That's the only way to do it. So in a sense, this is a necessary result of the sort of macroeconomy we have.
James, talking about the other big issue that is affecting the Chinese visit, Amnesty International were out in force today to protest strongly against the Chinese human rights abuses, the number of people executed. David Cameron has said that nothing is off the table when he has this meeting with Xi Jinping. How much do you think quite a lot of the United Kingdom is having to hold its nose and swallow when they deal with the likes of Xi Jinping? It does seem a paradox.
We're terribly good at it. I mean,
same as Saudi Arabia. Right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, when King Abdullah came and we laid on all of this same stuff, it was down to it was down to the horse guards who play the tune to insert a little bit of British humour into it by playing as King Abdullah walked across Horse Guards Parade up to see David Miliband, Foreign Secretary, Gordon Brown, Prime Minister, the Queen, and some of the other royalty whose names escape me right now.
I don't think it matters.
I don't think it matters. Playing the Darth Vader song from Star Wars. So I'm looking for that kind of slice of humour just to undercut us being a bit, just a bit weak.
Martin, still putting them on the Human Rights Council.
what tune do you think should have been played?
Well, look, I completely agree with this. I think, this is the sort of thing that has traditionally made it easy for other European countries to deride Britain as a sort of merchant nation, a nation of shopkeepers and so on. That would partly be redeemed if Britain was actually selling stuff. The problem, as I alluded to, is that the nation is still importing much more than it's exporting, which isn't a problem in the short run, but it does mean that you are living on other people's money.
Okay, let's move on now to Canada. Oh, Canada. Who is Justin Trudeau? Wow, he's hot. Just a few reactions to change at the top. A decade of Conservative rule ended a few hours ago in Canada with a decisive victory by the Liberals in the country's general election. It's been a significant turnaround for the party that a few months ago was trailing badly in third place. But what happens next? What kind of Canada will we see in the next few months and indeed years? Martin, let us evaluate the situation that Canada found itself in 48 hours ago under Stephen Harper's guise. A country moving further and further to the right. Arguably, some commentators were saying that the system was being Americanized a little bit too far. What's happened in the last 24 hours?
It's really paradoxical because the Liberals have clearly come from behind. They were in third place behind the more leftist party in the polls not so very long ago. Of course, it is a traditional strong force in Canadian politics. It used to be the sort of obvious ruling party. But then Stephen Harper has managed to run the country for a decade and, as you say, push the country in an economically and politically rightist direction. So one way of looking at this, and this is the reaction you see on the left, both in Europe, but especially in the US, is that This shows that you can run on a leftist, anti-austerity, inclusive, multiculturalist message. You know, what everyone associates with Canada as a traditional Canadian virtues, and win. But the paradox is that this is, of course, dynastic politics. Justin Trudeau is the son of Pierre Trudeau, who was the prime minister for I don't know how many years when the Liberal Party was running the country.
I'm going to say
younger
16.
Trudeau, something like at least more than 10. Justin Trudeau grew up, you know, part of his childhood was spent in the prime ministerial residence. And that strikes me as very American in the US sense.
Are we seeing, James, a more Canadian Canada emerging?
Well, far be it from me to decide what true Canadian virtues are. I think we like to read into them exactly like what we like to see. And yes, that sort of anti-austerity, more multicultural type of Canada is one that I prefer personally to Stephen Harper's. I'm very interested to see how this develops, because my understanding is that Trudeau Jr. ran... really took on the cultural liberal things and ran on those very hard, you know, incredibly pro-choice, and said none of his candidates couldn't be pro-choice, and fought back against Harper. Tried to do, it was classic Linton Crosby stuff. The guy who helped the Tories win the election used to do, he was there for,
he helped Harper, didn't he?
He helped Harper, and he did one of his classic wedge issues right at the end, which was the banning the headscarf at Canadian citizenship ceremonies. And it didn't work. It was like when he ran the 2005 Tory campaign and he tried these sort of slightly dog whistle-less, what they call the wedge issues. And they can backfire because people look at them and go, well, this isn't really important and that's a bit nasty. And it actually, I think, allowed a more, you know, perhaps a more liberal position than many Canadians want, to seem like a much more reasonable position than that which was trying to be put forward by Harper.
I think we can inform the dear listener that Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister between 1968 and 1979, and then 1980 and 84. He had two cracks at the whip.
16 years.
16 years, but split. So I don't know who wins on that one. It's evens, I'd suggest. Martin, the policy that Justin Trudeau, fresh face, just 43, but obviously the product of a great political dynasty, is saying it's going to cut the income taxes for the middle class, increasing them for the wealthy, run deficits for 3 years to pay for infrastructure spending, and then deal with environmental concerns. How does Canada approach that position when it knows it's going to have to spend its way out of trouble?
Well, look, it's a very reasonable economic position to say that you can borrow a bit, and certainly if you borrow to invest. That's what individuals do, countries do it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's better than the alternative. There's no need to balance budgets exactly. So that's not a worry. And I think also Canada has the wherewithal more than many other countries, because they had a pretty mild recession. They didn't have a banking crisis. They came out of it pretty well compared to many other countries. So in a sense, they're well positioned. But I think it's actually more interesting politically than it is economically. There's nothing untoward or outlandish about his economic positions, and it is a responsible party because it has that tradition of governing. What's going to be interesting is to see how that sort of message carries on rhetorically and whether it's copied in other countries. And I think we might see some of the candidates in the US presidential campaign. It sounds a bit strange, but they might look to Canada and see, well, it worked there. Maybe it can work for me, especially in the Democratic Party.
Let's talk finally on this subject about Canada's image abroad. It was the destination for the family of the refugees, the little boy who died on the beach in Bodrum. It has been participating in the US-led airstrikes in Syria. These are cornerstones of the Trudeau manifesto, which is to take in more Syrian refugees and to pull out of bombing raids against Islamic State. How much do you think Canada's voice will be listened to in the next few years?
Well, I don't know exactly how to judge that from the reactions in the first day, but and unfortunately, from having a look at have a look at my Twitter timeline, and most of the reactions about Trudeau, I had a lot which was about how he seemed nice and good looking, and how he had said, and he hadn't said that he did, that he was embarrassed by the fact he had smoked marijuana when he said that he had smoked marijuana, more than these more concrete and important issues, which might more reflect the fact that people don't look to Canada so much for international leadership. Perhaps he will change that, perhaps not.
You're listening to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson, joined in the studio by Martin Sanbu and James Schneider. After the break, we discuss the rise of the far right again in Europe, and the ASF gathers its forces in South Africa. Stay with us.
After New York, London and Hong Kong, get ready for the latest in our brilliant new series with the Monocle Travel Guide to Tokyo. Tokyo has a habit of confounding expectations, and few visitors leave anything less than awed. And you should join the fan club. Expect to fall in love with the dazzling food, sumptuous shopping, and the most courteous residents you'll ever meet. We'll point you in the right direction for everything from record shops to shiatsu massages. We've even picked out a few of our favourite buildings. Published by Gestalten, our travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. The Monocle Travel Guide to Tokyo. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
The time is 1920 if you're listening in Vienna or Berlin, 1820 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me, Martin Sanbu and James Schneider. We head now to Europe, the scene in the last 24 hours of many more thousands of refugees and migrants bottlenecked at borders on a continent which is founded on the principle that there internally should be none. As the path of those seeking a new life in Austria and Germany becomes ever more circuitous, the message from the far right in Europe is getting clearer. We are the side to back. We have seen, Martin, in the last 24 hours, 48 hours, the SVP in Switzerland now becoming the biggest party, and Pegida having a huge rally in Dresden. Mm. Let's begin with the SVP. It's now the biggest party in Switzerland, the Swiss People's Party. It is arguably, though, a country least affected by refugees, and the place where you could argue that it is no great surprise that the right have done well.
It's a very interesting country, isn't it? Because it's true, it's not so affected by refugees. It does have a lot of immigration, though, because it's a strong economy. It has a very international economy, the financial sector. So it actually has many working migrants. And that's part of what, I suppose, has driven the support for the SVP. But it's also a country that is quite clearly ensconced in the European structures, even though it's not a member of the EU, it's not a member of the European Economic Area that a country like Norway is part of. But if you remember a year or two back, there was a referendum where voters passed a motion that would crack down on immigrants' rights or other European workers' rights. And the European Union immediately said, that's not going to work. If you do that, we'll rescind all the other various cooperation agreements we have. And they're now working very hard to sort of undo what they had voted for. I'm bringing that up as an example because I think the SVP very clearly channels some sort of dissatisfaction among a segment of Swiss voters. But it's very unclear how they will ever get anywhere with it. Of course, add to that that the federal system in Switzerland is very weak. So even if they have a lot of members of the federal parliament, it's not clear that they'll be able to do very much.
You mentioned that that part of the Swiss electorate, which is finding its voice channeled through the SVP. I mean, the SVP have, 28-29% of the vote in the elections. That's a big chunk. I think it was perhaps your paper yesterday that warned Switzerland that to go down such a path could threaten its relationship with Europe, of which you spoke a moment ago. How much will it?
I doubt that they will very much, because I think that is sort of the limit we see in most countries to the support for that kind of party. You know, many countries have similar parties whose support is in the 20% range, at least outside of elections and sometimes in elections. The Front National in France, UKIP here, which is a milder version but channels some of the same dissatisfactions and nostalgia for an era that was thought to be better and simpler. So many countries actually have support sort of in that range, and they never really break out of that range. So I'm not all that worried about them getting even more support. What I am worried about is how do you maintain some sort of social harmony when up to a third of the population is that dissatisfied.
James, Martin there was talking about the channeling of the dissatisfaction that is felt in countries. With this rally in Dresden, I think it was expected 10,000 to hit the streets. No one's come out with an official figure yet because there were counter rallies as well. But in a country which has been seen so clearly as the flagship for being open and welcoming and accommodating to a crisis, to what degree the confusion of immigration and humanitarian issues happen here?
I mean, yes, they do, of course. And even when you speak to most of these far right parties, they always try to draw the distinction in some way, because they always try to say, "Oh, well, you know, we will accept some people, but some people is generally quite a small number. What we don't want is economic migrants," so they say. I mean, this is a symptom of a deeper problem in European political economy, I think, which is the way the economies are structured require a working class that comes in from the outside, or, you know, is supplemented from the outside. And the economies are not really able to structure, not really able to function if they don't do that. But then this is not some. But then the benefits of this are not necessarily evenly distributed. So this leaves quite large sections of the population who feel like they're not benefiting from something which is structurally integral to the way the economies function. So there needs to be, in some way, either, you know, which sounds extremely difficult, a very large change within European political economy in one direction or in another direction, or the benefits of that political economy need to be distributed in a way that reduces some of those grievances and undermines some of those narratives which can be persuasive to some, clearly are persuasive to quite a lot of people.
Martin, briefly on that point, we must move on to the African standby force in a moment, but James there was talking about this gap where people don't believe that they're reaping what immigrant workers are bringing them. Germany arguably is the country where it succeeded post-war, the influx of more than 3 million, the 1960s where half of Mercedes' workforce building cars were Turkish.
Germany, of course, has a special situation of reunification of the two Germanies 25 years ago, where on many measures it's been a great success, but the East, of course, still lags behind the West, and there are areas that were pretty much blighted by the way reunification happened. And I think those are the areas where the skepticism of foreigners is the greatest. But the optimistic view of this is that Germany is the country, more than any country in Europe, where these sorts of protests will be all the more shocking to the great majority of Germans that have this acute sense of Germany's very special history. And I think that makes me think that it will grow less than in other countries.
Finally, we discuss the African Union's new 25,000-strong multinational standby force gathering to begin field training in South Africa. James, this is a new force. It was agreed upon, 13 years ago, paid for by donations. How do you see this working then?
Well, it's another step in the development of a regional and African security architecture. It's not as bad as you suggest. Yes, there's some problems. Like, it was meant to happen last year and it couldn't happen because in Lesotho they had a coup and then counter thing. So it couldn't happen then. But this is actually something that's very important. There are real desire for African solutions to African security problems, to not always be looking to outsiders. And actually, African Union forces are, sure, they're funded by the outside a lot, but they're doing a lot in Somalia. They were an important part alongside the French in Mali, and they were playing an important role in the Central African Republic before being turned into a UN, before being rehatted as UN. So it's a very important development, but let's not get too excited. They're not going to be deploying as peacekeepers to do anything quite yet.
Martin, we have but a few seconds.
It just strikes me that in the last decade we've had crises in the West, economic crisis, disintegration in the Eurozone, all these terrible things, and we've kind of forgotten about Africa, partly because Africa's been humming along very nicely, thank you. Economically, it's been growing fast. I mean, to me, this sounds like another element of an increase in growing African self-confidence, and that can only be a good thing.
Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. On that note, I'm afraid we have to leave it. Martin Sandbu and James Schneider, thank you very much for joining me here in the studio at Midori House. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, researcher Henry Rhys Sheridan and Federica Romagnello, and our studio manager, Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Carlotta Ribello will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then at 1900 London time, it's David Pleasant here with Section D, and at 2200, the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House and from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.